Chapter 36. I can't see how I could possibly be of any help to you, she murmured, drawing back a little from the mounting excitement of his look. Her tone seemed to sober him, as it had so often done in his stormiest moments. The stubborn lines of his face relaxed, and he said, with an abrupt drop to docility, colon, you would see, if you'd be as merciful as you used to be. And heaven knows I've never needed it more. She paused a moment, moved in spite of herself by this reminder of her influence over him. Her fibers had been softened by suffering, and the sudden glimpse into his mocked and broken life disarmed her contempt for his weakness. I am very sorry for you, I would help you willingly, but you must have other friends, other advisors. I never had a friend like you, he answered simply. And besides, can't you see? You're the only person, his voice dropped to a whisper, the only person who knows. Again she felt her color change. Again her heart rose in precipitate throbs to meet what she felt was coming. He lifted his eyes to her entreatingly. Why, you do see, don't you? You understand? I'm desperate, I'm at the end of my tether. I want to be free, and you can free me. I know you can. You don't want to keep me bound fast in hell, do you? You can't want to take such a vengeance as that. You were always kind, your eyes are kind now. You say you're sorry for me. Well, it rests with you to show it, and heaven knows there's nothing to keep you back. You understand, of course there wouldn't be a hint of publicity, not a sound or a syllable, to connect you with the thing. It would never come to that, you know. All I need is to be able to say definitely, colon, I know this and this and this is, and the fight would drop, and the way be cleared, and the whole abominable business swept out of sight in a second. He spoke pantingly, like a tired runner, with breaks of exhaustion between his words, and through the breaks she caught, as through the shifting rents of a fog, great golden vistas of peace and safety. For there was no mistaking the definite intention behind his vague appeal. She could have filled up the blanks without the help of Mrs. Fisher's insinuations. Here was a man who turned to her in the extremity of his loneliness and his humiliation. If she came to him at such a moment, he would be hers with all the force of his deluded faith. And the power to make him so lay in her hand lay there in a completeness he could not even remotely conjecture. Revenge and rehabilitation might be hers at a stroke. There was something dazzling in the completeness of the opportunity. She stood silent, gazing away from him down the autumnal stretch of the deserted lane. And suddenly fear possessed her, fear of herself, and of the terrible force of the temptation. All her past weaknesses were like so many eager accomplices drawing her toward the path their feet had already smoothed. She turned quickly, and held out her hand to Dorset. Goodbye, I'm sorry, there's nothing in the world that I can do. Nothing? Ah, don't say that, he cried. Say what's true. That you abandoned me like the others. You, the only creature who could have saved me. Goodbye, goodbye, she repeated hurriedly, and as she moved away she heard him cry out on a last note of entreaty, colon, at least you will let me see you once more? Lily, on regaining the Gormer grounds, struck rapidly across the lawn toward the unfinished house, where she fancied that her hostess might be speculating, not too resignedly, on the cause of her delay. For, like many unpunctual persons, Mrs. Gormer disliked to be kept waiting. As Miss Bart reached the avenue, however, she saw a smart phaeton with a high-stepping pair disappear behind the shrubbery in the direction of the gate. And on the doorstep stood Mrs. Gormer, with a glow of retrospective pleasure on her open countenance. At sight of Lily the glow deepened to an embarrassed red, and she said with a slight laugh, colon, did you see my visitor? Oh, I thought you came back by the avenue. It was Mrs. George Dorset, she said she dropped in to make a neighborly call. Lily met the announcement with her usual composure, though her experience of Bertha's idiosyncrasies would not have led her to include the neighborly instinct among them. and Mrs. Gormer, relieved to see that she gave no sign of surprise, went on with a deprecating laugh. Colon, of course, what really brought her was curiosity. She made me take her all over the house. But no one could have been nicer, no airs, you know, and so good-natured. I can quite see why people think her so fascinating. This surprising event, coinciding too completely with her meeting with Dorset, to be regarded as contingent upon it, had yet immediately struck Lily with a vague sense of foreboding. It was not in Bertha's habits to be neighborly, much less to make advances to anyone outside the immediate circle of her affinities. As he had always consistently ignored the world of outer aspirants, or had recognized its individual members only when prompted by motives of self-interest, and the very capriciousness of her condescensions had, as Lily was aware, given them special value in the eyes of the persons she distinguished. Lily saw this now in Mrs. Gormer's unconcealable complacency, and in the happy irrelevance with which, for the next day or two, she quoted Bertha's opinions and speculated on the origin of her gown. All the secret ambitions which Mrs. Gormer's native indolence, and the attitude of her companions, kept in habitual abeyance, were now germinating afresh in the glow of Bertha's advances. And whatever the cause of the latter, Lily saw that, if they were followed up, they were likely to have a disturbing effect upon her own future. As he had arranged to break the length of her stay with her new friends by one or two visits to other acquaintances as recent, and on her return from this somewhat depressing excursion she was immediately conscious that Mrs. Dorset's influence was still in the air. There had been another exchange of visits, a tea at a country club, an encounter at a hunt ball. There was even a rumor of an approaching dinner, which Mattie Gormer, with an unnatural effort at discretion, tried to smuggle out of the conversation whenever Miss Bart took part in it. The latter had already planned to return to town after a farewell Sunday with her friends, and, with Gertie Farish's aid, had discovered a small private hotel where she might establish herself for the winter. The hotel being on the edge of a fashionable neighborhood, the price of the few square feet she was to occupy was considerably in excess of her means, but she found a justification for her dislike of poorer quarters in the argument that, at this particular juncture, it was of the utmost importance to keep up a show of prosperity. In reality, it was impossible for her, while less he had the means, to pay her way for a week ahead, to lapse into a form of existence like Gertie Farish's. As he had never been so near the brink of insolvency, but she could at least manage to meet her weekly hotel bill, and having settled the heaviest of her previous debts out of the money as he had received from Trina, as he had a still fair margin of credit to go upon. The situation, however, was not agreeable enough to lull her to complete unconsciousness of its insecurity. Her rooms, with their cramped outlook down a sallow vista of brick walls and fire escapes, her lonely meals in the dark restaurant with its surcharged ceiling and haunting smell of coffee, all these material discomforts, which were yet to be accounted as so many privileges soon to be withdrawn, kept constantly before her the disadvantages of her state, and her mind reverted the more insistently to Mrs. Fisher's counsels. Beat about the question as she would, she knew the outcome of it was that she must try to marry Rosedale, and in this conviction she was fortified by an unexpected visit from George Dorset. She found him, on the first Sunday after her return to town, pacing her narrow sitting room to the imminent peril of the few knick-knacks with which as he had tried to disguise its plush exuberances. But the sight of her seemed to quiet him, and he said meekly that he hadn't come to bother her, that he asked only to be allowed to sit for half an hour and talk of anything she liked. In reality, as she knew, he had but one subject, himself and his wretchedness, and it was the need of her sympathy that had drawn him back. But he began with a pretense of questioning her about herself, and as she replied, she saw that, for the first time, a faint realization of her plight penetrated the dense surface of his self-absorption. Was it possible that her old beast of an aunt had actually cut her off? That she was living alone like this, because there was no one else for her to go to, and that she really hadn't more than enough to keep alive until the wretched little legacy was paid? The fibers of sympathy were nearly atrophied in him, but he was suffering so intensely that he had a faint glimpse of what other sufferings might mean, and, as she perceived, an almost simultaneous perception of the way in which her particular misfortunes might serve him. When at length she dismissed him, on the pretext that she must dress for dinner, he lingered entreatingly on the threshold, to blurt out, "Colin, it's been such a comfort to say you'll let me see you again," but to this direct appeal it was impossible to give an assent, and she said with friendly decisiveness, "Colin, I'm sorry, but you know why I can't." He colored to the eyes, pushed the door shut, and stood before her embarrassed but insistent. I know how you might, if you would, if things were different, and it lies with you to make them so. It's just a word to say, and you put me out of my misery." Their eyes met, and for a second she trembled again with the nearness of the temptation. "Why, you're mistaken. I know nothing. I saw nothing," she exclaimed, striving, by sheer force of reiteration, to build a barrier between herself and her peril. And as he turned away, groaning out, "You sacrifice us both," she continued to repeat, as if it were a charm, "Colin, I know nothing, absolutely nothing." Lily had seen little of Rosedale since her illuminating talk with Mrs. Fisher, but on the two or three occasions when they had met she was conscious of having distinctly advanced in his favor. There could be no doubt that he admired her as much as ever, and she believed it rested with herself to raise his admiration to the point where it should bear down the lingering counsels of expediency. The task was not an easy one, but neither was it easy, in her long sleepless nights, to face the thought of what George Dorset was so clearly ready to offer. Baseness for baseness, she hated the other least. There were even moments when a marriage with Rosedale seemed the only honorable solution of her difficulties. She did not, indeed, let her imagination range beyond the day of plighting. After that, everything faded into a haze of material well-being, in which the personality of her benefactor remained mercifully vague. As he had learned, in her long vigils, that there were certain things not good to think of, certain midnight images that must at any cost be exorcised, and one of these was the image of herself as Rosedale's wife. Carrie Fisher, on the strength, as she frankly owned, of the bride's Newport success, had taken for the autumn months a small house at Tuxedo, and thither Lily was bound on the Sunday after Dorset's visit. Though it was nearly dinner time when she arrived, her hostess was still out, and the firelit quiet of the small silent house descended on her spirit with a sense of peace and familiarity. It may be doubted if such an emotion had ever before been evoked by Carrie Fisher's surroundings, but, contrasted to the world in which Lily had lately lived, there was an air of repose and stability in the very placing of the furniture, and in the quiet competence of the parlor maid who led her up to her room. Mrs. Fisher's unconventionality was, after all, a merely superficial divergence from an inherited social creed, while the manners of the Gormer circle represented their first attempt to formulate such a creed for themselves. It was the first time since her return from Europe that Lily had found herself in a congenial atmosphere, and the stirring of familiar associations had almost prepared her, as she descended the stairs before dinner, to enter upon a group of her old acquaintances. But this expectation was instantly checked by the reflection that the friends who remained loyal were precisely those who would be least willing to expose her to such encounters. And it was hardly with surprise that she found, instead, Mr. Rosedale kneeling domestically on the drawing-room hearth before his hostess's little girl. Rosedale in the paternal role was hardly a figure to soften Lily, yet she could not but notice a quality of homely goodness in his advances to the child. they were not, at any rate, the premeditated and perfunctory endearments of the guest under his hostess's eye, for he and the little girl had the room to themselves, and something in his attitude made him seem a simple and kindly being compared to the small critical creature who endured his homage. Yes, he would be kind Lily, from the threshold, had time to feel kind in his gross, unscrupulous, rapacious way, the way of the predatory creature with his mate. As he had but a moment in which to consider whether this glimpse of the fireside man mitigated a repugnance, or gave it, rather, a more concrete and intimate form. For at sight of her, he was immediately on his feet again, the florid and dominant Rosedale of Mattie Gormer's drawing room. It was no surprise to Lily to find that he had been selected as her only fellow guest. Though she and her hostess had not met since the latter's tentative discussion of her future, Lily knew that the acuteness which enabled Mrs. Fisher to lay a safe and pleasant course through a world of antagonistic forces was not infrequently exercised for the benefit of her friends. It was, in fact, characteristic of Carrie that, while she actively gleaned her own stores from the fields of affluence, her real sympathies were on the other side with the unlucky, the unpopular, the unsuccessful, with all her hungry fellow toilers in the shorn stubble of success. Mrs. Fisher's experience guarded her against the mistake of exposing Lily, for the first evening, to the unmitigated impression of Rosedale's personality. Kate Corby and two or three men dropped in to dinner, and Lily, alive to every detail of her friend's method, saw that such opportunities as had been contrived for her were to be deferred till as he had, as it were, gained courage to make effectual use of them. As he had a sense of acquiescing in this plan with the passiveness of a sufferer resigned to the surgeon's touch. And this feeling of almost lethargic helplessness continued when, after the departure of the guests, Mrs. Fisher followed her upstairs. "May I come in and smoke a cigarette over your fire? If we talk in my room, we shall disturb the child." Mrs. Fisher looked about her with the eye of the solicitous hostess. I hope you've managed to make yourself comfortable, dear. Isn't it a jolly little house? It's such a blessing to have a few quiet weeks with the baby." Carrie, in her rare moments of prosperity, became so expansively maternal that Miss Bart sometimes wondered whether, if she could ever get time and money enough, she would not end by devoting them both to her daughter. "It's a well-earned rest. I'll say that for myself," she continued, sinking down with a sigh of content on the pillowed lounge near the fire. "Louis Abry is a stern taskmaster. I often used to wish myself back with the Gormers. Talk of love-making. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.